States Dressage Federation's official podcast. Hello and welcome to the program. I'm Chris Stafford. On the show this week, we'll be hearing from Elizabeth Berenfield, who will be part of our spotlight on the USDF Dover Saddlery Medal program. And then Dr. Hilary Clayton will be here for the start of a two-part series on footing. But first of all, with regard to the USDF Dover Saddlery Medal program, which provides adult amateurs riding at second level an excellent opportunity for recognition, those medals are awarded to the highest scoring adult amateur who obtains a score of at least 60% in the designated class. Medal recipients receive a custom pewter medal with neck ribbon and a Dover Saddlery gift certificate for each of the three USDF Dover Saddlery medals they win during the competition year. Winners of three or more medals in a competition year are ranked in the Dover National Merit Award standings. The USDF Dover Saddlery Adult Amateur Medal National Champion and Reserve Champion are awarded to the riders with the highest and second highest average of their top three scores of their USDF Dover Saddlery Adult Medal winning rides during the competition year. The USDF Dover Saddlery Adult Amateur Medal National Champion will receive a $1,000 Dover Saddlery gift certificate, and the Reserve Champion will receive a $500 Dover Saddlery gift certificate. The USDF Dover Saddlery Adult Amateur Medal National Champion and Reserve Champion Awards are presented at the Adequan USDF Annual Convention later on in the year. And you can find more information on this and other awards at the USDF Awards website. And our first guest this week is Liz Berenfield. In the April issue of The Connection magazine, which features an unexpected partner, the author Megan Brinks introduces us to the 2015 USDF Dover Saddlery Adult Amateur Medal National Champion. And she joins me now. Hi, Liz. Welcome to the program.
Hello.
Well, first of all, congratulations. The winner of the Dover Medal, which is a prestigious award for an adult amateur, and you've been an amateur for how long now have you been in the sport, Liz?
Let's see, I've been riding most of my life. I was a hunter jumper rider until I turned 30 and moved to the East Coast. And then when I moved to the East Coast, couldn't find a hunter jumper barn where we lived. There was a dressage barn, and my mom rides dressage. So I guess for a long time.
So you were imprinted, were you, that it was definitely going to be horses?
Yep, definitely. Yep, my mother is, 78, and she has her horse with me, and she still rides four times a week, and did her century ride 2 years ago.
Oh, wonderful. She's a member of the Century Club.
Yes, she is.
Fabulous, fabulous. So what is it about dressage, then, that picks up the challenges that you didn't have in the hunter-jumper world?
Oh, I think it's just the the thinking that goes behind it requires a lot of patience and a lot of thought, and you're always learning, and you're never quite riding well enough. So there's always a learning curve.
Right. Now, we should explain your day job is as a small animal veterinarian.
Mm-hmm.
So the horses play a part-time role in your life, but nonetheless obviously very satisfying now that you're dedicated dressage enthusiast. So tell us what this means to you, winning this award.
Oh, it was just unexpected and very fun. And it was quite a fun show year, I must admit. The horse that I did it with was quite lovely, and it was just a great year, unexpected.
All right. Well, that was last year, but I'm sure you've been riding that particular partner for a while longer. You have two horses, so tell us about both of them and the one that you partnered to win this medal.
I had purchased a young horse about 4 years ago, and when he turned four, he actually succumbed to lymphoma. So I was horseless for a couple of years, and I bought my young horse, who's a five-year-old Hungarian, from a friend who desperately needed to sell him and try to find him at the right home. And that's the young horse that I have. And then the horse that I won the Dover Medal on, one of my friends, Kathy Casey, who's a trainer here in Oregon, pulled me aside and said, you need to come and look at this horse. And I really wasn't interested in having two horses. I can barely afford and deal with one. But I went to go see her and brought her home, too. So in the course of a week, I went from no horses to two horses. And so that was fun. So I got both of them November last year, or I guess November 2014. So I haven't had her much more than a year and a half.
Tell us about her. What breed is she? How's she bred? And what sort of age? And where she was in her training that you picked up?
Yeah. On? Yeah. She's a Hackney harness horse, crossed with a Dutch. She was bred at Fresno State. Alyssa Pitts started her and showed her through second for a couple of years and then sold her to an older woman. And there I kind of lose her story. I know she wasn't shown. She didn't have much done with her. So for about 10 years, she was pretty much under the radar. And then that woman ended up getting a divorce and needing to sell her, and that's how she ended up in Kathy's hands. So she had a good start because Alyssa did a great job with her, but then she didn't do too much after that until I got her.
And then what happened? Pick up the story from there and the kind of showing schedule that you had last year that led you to this result.
Yeah, well, we had a few issues at the beginning. She's a redhead, so she's a little spicy, and she's still spicy. She's pretty spooky. She ended up colicking multiple times when I first purchased her. We were at the Oregon State University Teaching Hospital maybe a half a dozen times with her colicking, and then she has really bad allergies to no-see-ums. I actually showed her all last year with a roached mane because she didn't have a mane left, I guess Alyssa told me that her brother was the same way, so it's obviously a hereditary deal. And we started showing, I think the first show we did about five recognized shows, and she was great. I think she got multiple scores over 70 at second, and she was just a ton of fun. So, and then we won our state championships and then regionals. So she was pretty spectacular.
And being a mare, is she very marish? I mean, how would you characterize her?
Yeah, she's very marish. When I first got her, she actually tried to breed a fence post, so she got promptly put on regimate. so she's better, but she's very, very, very marish. Yeah.
Now, how do you deal with that when it comes to competitions?
You know, it's interesting. My last horse that I showed many years ago was a gelding, and he was a slug and didn't want to go ever. And she is hot. And when she gets into the arena, it's just such a much different experience to be able to sit there and finesse your way around instead of pushing your way around the arena. So actually, in a way, it works to my favor, I think.
Now, what sort of things have you had to particularly focus on then this past year, and has that changed over this winter? Talk us through that training arch, so to speak.
Yeah. So I guess because of the Hackney in her, she wants to curl and not take contact. That has been the big issue, and I think that'll probably always be an issue. She's pretty talented. But she's just tense and tight, and for example, we are now having to work on flying changes, and they are very expressive. Would be a kind word to say about them. A few people have seen her belly button.
So a work in progress.
A work in progress. Yes, definitely.
Now, what will you do with her this year then, Liz?
Well, I don't know. Obviously, if I can, I'm going to show her third and hopefully do that. We'll see how the changes go, see if we can get that sorted out or not. And if not, that's okay. We'll just keep practicing.
And how old is she now?
She's 15.
Right. So she's maybe got some, if she's sound, she's got some mileage left in her for you.
Yeah, she is. She's very sound. She's very well put together. So she hopefully will hold out for a few more years. for me.
Now, winning that medal, has that made you more ambitious?
Oh, boy. You know, it was a really amazing thing to win, and it was I felt very honored to do that, and it was great, but, you know, I always need to have the horse tell me what they're ready to do, and I have no intentions of doing anything to either one of them that they're not ready for. So, you know, in a way, no, I would say no.
All right. You're quite happy to continue on the journey with her and let her listen to her, let her tell you what she wants to do then.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And if her brain doesn't want to do it, she doesn't have to do it. I know I'm not going to make her do something she doesn't want to do.
Now, what about the young horse?
He is actually, I show him in the league shows. I might show him in the open shows. He's kind of training first, a little bit of second level. I actually just shipped him off to a friend of mine for a month to do, to learn how to jump fences. Just because I think that's super important for young horses to learn how to do all that stuff. And so I've just got him back and we'll see what he wants to do. He may end up wanting to be a hunter. I don't know. We'll see.
Who do you train with, Liz?
Let's see. I've clinicked with lots and lots of people. I regularly train with Kimberly Barker and Tina Stewart, who are in this area. Those are probably my two regulars.
Right.
But I've clinicked with quite a few people.
And what's the competition schedule in front of you? Tell us where you're going to be going next.
Well, it depends on the flying changes. if they go well, then I'm going to do, we have a show called Heart of the Valley, which is at a really nice facility called Devonwood that's here in Oregon. And that will be happening in the first part of May. And then we have a great horse show that's actually done on grass. It's run really well down in Northern California, and we'll do that at the end of June. And then there's a show in Bend that's lovely, that's on the eastern side of the state, and then probably championships.
Right.
If all goes well.
If all goes well.
It depends.
One flying change at a time.
Exactly. You got it.
Perfect. All right. Well, Liz, well, congratulations again on winning that Dover Medal Championship, and the very best of luck to you with that mare. You must also tell us her name so we know who to look out for.
Oh, yes. It's Guinevere.
Guinevere. Okay. Well, the very best of luck this season and beyond with her.
Great. Thank you so much.
And as I mentioned earlier, you can read more about Liz in the April issue of the USDF Connection magazine. And now in our education segment, we begin a two-part series, which was taken from an education session at the 2015 Adequan USDF Annual Convention entitled What Every Dressage Rider Should Know About Footing. And it's presented by Dr. Hilary Clayton.
So arena design and configuration, maintenance and so on is really a very broad topic. And I'm not going to even try to cover that whole spectrum today. What I'm going to talk about is specifically the footing on top of the arena that the horse's foot is in direct contact with. And I hope that at the end of the talk, you'll be better positioned to make good choices about what kind of footing you want to ride on and what kind of footing you want to put in your own arena. If you're interested in arena construction and design, USDF is coming out with a new edition of Underfoot, and of course that covers all aspects of putting in an arena. So you can't avoid footing, can you? If we want to do athletic pursuits with our horses, they're going to be moving, their feet are going to be touching the ground. We're going to have to be concerned about what kind of footing they move on. So although we can't avoid footing, we can certainly make choices. And you make a choice every day when you decide what type of footing to work on. And that choice is important because it's going to affect not only your horse's performance today, but also the horse's soundness and longevity over, you know, the horse's entire performance lifetime. And it's also going to affect both your safety and your horse's safety. So it really is quite an important choice that you're making every day. So what do I think you need to know about footing? Well, I think you need to understand how the horse's hoof interacts with the surface as he steps on it. And we're going to talk about the impact phase, the loading phase, and the propulsion stages of the stride. And then I think it's important to have some knowledge about how the properties of the footing affect the horse's hoof and the rest of the horse's limb, and indeed they're going to affect the horse's entire body in terms of his locomotor pattern. And we're also going to look at how different dressage movements have different requirements from the footing. Right? So footing is a sport-specific aid to performance, if you like, and what we want as dressage riders is not the same as what the jumper riders would want, for example. Now, everybody has an opinion about footing, and you will not go out of here as experts in footing. But what you should be able to do is be better prepared to be able to talk to the experts and discuss the issues that they raise. Okay, so we do have footing consultants who make a living out of doing footing, but I think it's important for you to be able to talk to them in terms of the words that they understand and to know the words that they're going to use. And if you want more information beyond what I give you today, there's this very nice white paper that was commissioned by the FEI, and it's on the FEI website. If you just search for equine surfaces white paper, you'll be able to find it. Now, years ago, we used to ride on the grass, and it never bothered us, did it? There's been a transition to now using surfaces that are either entirely based on sand or sand with other things added to it. The reason that these changes came about was mostly because people wanted to be able to ride year-round, and turf, of course, is not really amenable to that. And we don't have control over the weather. Turf is very susceptible to the amount of rainfall and that kind of thing. So sand is much more, in a way, flexible as an arena surface. So what is sand? Well, it's a mineral that's been crushed into small grains. But sand is not all the same. You know, if you go to the quarry, you'll see big piles of different types of sand. So clearly, what kind of sand to use is going to be one of the decisions that has to be made. And sand varies in terms of the shape and size and hardness of the individual grains of sand. So if we think about, first of all, the size of the sand grains, they range in size from very coarse grains, 1 to 2 millimeters, which is almost like fine gravel, down to very fine grains that are 0.05 to 0.1 of a millimeter, which is really small. Now, your local extension or soil department can do an analysis of different sands for you. They put the sand through successively smaller sieves and look at how much sand gets trapped in each sieve to determine the sizes of the sand grains in certain bands. So why are we concerned about the size of the sand grains? Well, this affects a lot of the important properties of the arena. It affects how much the surface compacts, how much it holds the water, whether it's dusty. I think these are all things that we can identify with as being concerns that we would have in constructing an arena. Generally, when all the grains of sand are similar in size, they have low cohesion, so they tend to leave deep hoof prints when the horse steps on the sand, and they may also tend to give way as the horse pushes against the sand. So usually, the sand in an arena will be a mixture of different sizes of grains. And often, we'll use something to help to bind the sand together or make it more stable. What about the shape of the sand grains? You would hardly think that would be important, would you? You get angular grains and more rounded grains. The rounded sand grains would be like riding on tiny little ball bearings in that they would tend to roll against each other. So that kind of footing tends not to be very stable. The angular grains give us a more stable type of footing. and one that requires less maintenance. The rounded grains tend to, you know, mound up at the side of the arena. You get a crack forming very easily. So that's a higher maintenance type of sand. Now, the mineral content, most sands used in arena construction these days are more than 90% silica sand, which is a very hard sand, so it doesn't break down into dust. Right? The problem is with the soft sand that the abrasion of the hooves breaks it down into very fine dusty particles, then that comes up into the air. You can actually test a sand sample very easily. Put a little bit of it on a hard surface and take the back of a spoon and crush it. If it crushes easily, then it's a soft sand. Moisture content has a huge effect on the properties of sand. So when the sand is wet, sand gets quite a lot harder. Okay? But when it's really dry, then it's very tiring for the horses. And, you know, you've all walked on the beach. You know, it's much easier to walk on the wet sand near the ocean than it is to walk on the dry sand on the dunes. And the reason for that is that when you go to push off on the dry sand, it gives way. So your muscles have to work harder to push against that sand and keep you moving forward. You know, and as we go through this talk, you're going to hear that there are always pros and cons. And in many cases, somewhere in the middle is where you want to be with the footing. You don't want to be at either kind of extreme. So we don't want the sand to be too wet, and we don't want it to be too dry. Now, I said right from the beginning that we do have options in footing. And the same option does not work under all circumstances. And there can, in fact, be several different types or combinations of footing that work equally well, but they're very different from each other. It's not a bad idea if you have a friend who has footing that you really like to do the same thing, but don't think that it necessarily always has to be exactly the same formula. Right? There can be different formulas, and both of those will work. And choosing what's going to work for you is partly based on, you know, what you know about different types of footing, what type of activities are going to be done on the footing, whether it's indoors or outdoors, but also, very importantly, what you can afford. And, you know, the dollar factor, I think, is very important, because some of the footings that we have nowadays are tens of thousands of dollars for a dressage arena, and that's clearly not within everybody's budget. But you don't have to spend tens of thousands of dollars to get footing that is safe and will allow you to train the horse adequately and with minimal risk of injury. Now, footing is not the only thing. If you were putting in a new arena, you would have to think about the base, the drainage, how it's going to be maintained, the atmosphere, how much rain it's going to be exposed to if it's outdoors, how hot it's going to be. And if you're renovating an old arena, you know, the age, depth of the footing are things that you'll be looking at that might need to be fixed. But we're not going to get into most of those in this talk. Like I said, I'm going to focus on the actual footing. So with this idea that there's more than one option that can work, here are some examples. A lot of arenas now are being constructed out of 6-inch deep, very fine, angular or subangular silica sand. And that sand can have up to 15% of very fine sandy particles, clay or silt content. Right? And a lot of arenas are using just that kind of sand. Other arenas are using fibers to improve the stability of the sand and improve the drainage. So what happens when you put fibrous material in with the sand is that the fibers act like the roots of grass in the soil. And what the roots do is that they stabilize the soil when the horse pushes off against it. So having fibers in the sand makes the sand more stable. It doesn't roll away from the horse's hoof as much. And it can also help to improve the drainage because it kind of loosens up the sand a little bit. A lot of arenas have rubber in them. You can get rubber in like big chunks, 1 inch to 2 inches, that go on the surface of the arena. my impression of that type of rubber is that it tends to be rather insecure footing for the horses. So I would actually prefer the smaller crumb rubber, which is little pieces, sort of, they look kind of like chocolate chips. They're about a quarter of an inch in diameter. And they're meant to be mixed in with the sand. Now, the thing about rubber is that when it's compressed, when the horse steps on these little crumbs of rubber, it compresses them in one direction, but they bulge out in the opposite direction. So the rubber doesn't change its volume, it just changes its shape. And when it bulges out into the sand, it actually loosens up the sand. So having little rubber crumbs in your sand footing is actually quite good for keeping the footing sort of loose. And it may also help improve drainage. And rubber is also somewhat of a shock absorber. A lot of the arenas these days are composite synthetic surfaces. So they'll be based usually on sand, but with added fibers. They might be natural fibers or synthetic fibers. And the fibers vary in length in different products. They'll also often have some pieces of rubber. They may be very tiny rubber pieces. And also they can have strips of cloth or strips of felt. There are lots of different kind of formulas. And very often they'll have a coating of polymer or wax put on them. And that sometimes coats the sand and makes it hydrophobic, which means it repels water. Or it can act as a binder so that it kind of increases the cohesiveness of the arena surface. Do be aware that wax melts in very high temperatures. And the synthetic tracks that they have on race courses now, in certain parts of the country, that wax will melt on really hot days. And if you look at the race times are always slower on those very hot days because of the difference in the surface properties when the wax actually melts. But having the wax or the polymer will certainly help to keep down the dust, and that's one of the big advantages. And you don't have to water it, I should say that too. So, I want to go on now and look at how the hoof actually interacts with this footing. So, very important in terms of the hoof interaction with the footing is the impact phase. And the impact phase is the time when the foot actually first contacts the footing. From that first contact until the foot comes to rest. So immediately prior to contact, the hoof is moving forwards and downwards towards the ground. So when it touches the ground, it has this forward and downward velocity, and it has to be slowed down to have zero velocity. So first of all, the downward movement is slowed, and then the forward movement is slowed. So first of all, there's a vertical deceleration, then there's a horizontal deceleration. During every stride that the horse takes, each one of his four legs is in contact with the ground for a period of time, and it's swinging forward through the air for a period of time. The time when it's on the ground is called the stance phase. The time when it's on the air is called the swing phase. So if we think of this horse galloping along, maybe he's going 30 miles an hour, his body is moving along at more or less constant 30 miles an hour speed. When the hoof is on the ground, it has zero velocity, and the body is moving forwards over that grounded hoof. And then when the body has come to be about as far forward as it can be ahead of the hoof is going to leave the ground, swing forward, it's going to accelerate relative to the horse's body, and then reach out in front of the horse and come back to the next stance phase. Okay, so unlike a bicycle that has wheels going round and round, the horse has legs going forward and back, protracting and retracting. They protract in the swing phase, they retract when the hoof is on the ground, and when the hoof is on the ground, it's pushing into the ground and projecting the horse forward. That's the propulsive forces that we talk about.
And our thanks again to Dr. Hilary Clayton for that segment. We will be continuing that next week here on the USDF official podcast. And in the meanwhile, if you'd like more information and resources on dressage arena footing, The new 2015 edition of Underfoot is now available at the website usdf.org, and you can also find a printed version on the USDF online store. For more educational material on these and many other topics here at the USDF, please visit eTrack, the USDF's online learning center and resource. And that's it for this week's episode. Don't forget you can keep up to date with us on our social media networks at Facebook and through the new USDF Connection app. Until next time, thank you for listening wherever you are in the world. And remember, the USDF is your connection to the American dressage community.